Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show. This is Frost. This is the pilot show, and I'm here with Chad Moore, creative director at Carbine Studios on the game WildStar. Chad, how you doing?
How are you doing, Frost? Hey, I just wanted to say it's a privilege to be on your pilot show.
You are, Devastation. You are number one for Game Devastation for two reasons. One, I couldn't get anybody else that quickly.
You know what? I'm out of here.
Number two. My agent. Hey, whoa, easy. Number two, you know, you volunteered pretty quickly. You were up on Twitter and you said, I'd be down for that.
Hey, man. I also said that I'd only do it, though, if you interviewed me every week and not just the first week.
That's true. We'll talk about that.
Maybe I can be like your Ed McMahon, you know.
Oh, dude.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, if I can point at you and you go, hey-o, I'd be fine with that.
You are correct, sir.
So, there's my dog, Eugene, by the way. You guys are probably going to hear that a lot. I'm going to warn you right now. We're at my house in Anaheim. My dog Eugene barks at everything, so super professional here on the podcast. And just as background information, we're going to be putting up a Patreon page. So if you want to hear more of these shows and maybe get us some egg crates and things like that, so we can actually make the show somewhat professional, please feel free to donate any money to that Patreon page. So Chad, let's just get into it, man. This show I wanted to kind of make about game development. And you know, different people. So for you, you have a background in a lot of different positions.
Yeah.
So you've been a narrative designer, you've been a creative director, and you've also been a 3D artist, correct?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so how did you get your start in the industry?
So, you know, to be completely honest, I got in the industry at a time when it actually didn't require any real art skill whatsoever. I do kind of laugh about that, but to a certain degree, it was true. When I got in, this was back, you know, in the 90s, okay? And I got some experience using a 3D package called Alias.
Okay.
You know, I was living in New York at the time, and I got some experience using this 3D package. You know, learned just the bare bones basics of it, kind of self-taught, and was just doing some work for a friend of mine up at Columbia University. And then what I realized a few months later, as I started to send my tape out, which had some really terrible work on it, actually, right? The centerpiece of which was a 3D rollerblade, okay? Yeah, it was pretty pretty ridiculous. But what I realized was that Alias at the time was the premier package, right, for doing 3D work, both in movies and in video games. And right. So anybody whatsoever at the time who had experience using it, regardless of skill level, was a commodity. And so I got in at a company called Interplay, which, you know, made some pretty big games back in the day.
R.I.P., by the way.
Yeah, R.I.P., yeah. Brian Fargo. But he's risen again, right?
Yeah, he's doing some pretty good
Wasteland
stuff.
Wasteland 2.
Yeah.
Anyway, they took pity on me, brought me in, and I got my first job as a 3D modeler using Alias back in 1995, January of 95.
Wow.
And so, you know, pretty quickly got in, met some really talented people who kind of showed me the ropes and, you know, showed me that I actually really didn't know anything at all. So got in, learned some stuff, and I started working on my first project in the industry, which was a PlayStation game called Red Asphalt.
Nice. Yes. I played Red Asphalt.
Oh, you did?
Dude, back in the day. It was a car game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I apologize.
No, hey, you know what? At the time, I was like, well, not bad. That was my little kid voice.
Right.
So you got in at Interplay. You worked on Red Asphalt. What other games did you work on there?
So Red Asphalt took 3 years, and then I started working on a game called Stone Keep 2.
Mm.
So Stone Keep 1 was actually one of Interplay's kind of flagship titles.
Right.
It was kind of a pseudo 3D game, you know, where it's kind of like a almost Myst style, where there was this series of images, right, where you'd go through these dungeons. And so they wanted to do a real 3D version of Stone Keep. And so I was working on that, and that actually just never happened. So, like, as I was working on that game, I had been talking a lot with the guys who worked on the original Fallout. So Tim Kaine, Leonard Boyarsky, Jason Anderson, they were really good friends of mine from almost the very beginning of when I started working at Interplay. And after they shipped Fallout, they broke off and they started a studio called Troika Games. And so, you know, after working on Stonekeep 2 for a little while, didn't seem to really be going anywhere. And so I jumped ship and went over and started working with those guys on their very first original IP, which was called Arcanum.
So and on Arcanum, were you an artist as well on that?
So I was. I did a number of the 3D characters, the 3D animated. It was a 2D isometric game. So. Right. Some of the player characters, right? We had dwarves and ogres and half-orcs. And but a lot of what I did on that game actually was also design. So I did some art, but then I also did a lot of character development, dialogue writing, scripting. We actually had our own proprietary scripting language that had been written by Tim Kaine. And so I learned a lot, actually, about game design and like mission design, quest design, and scripting and that kind of thing working on Arcanum. So I kind of split duties on both, which is really kind of the genesis of where my writing and design career in video games began.
Okay, cool. And so from there, we went to you went to Activision, right?
Yeah, so we shipped Arcanum.
Right.
And then we worked on a game called Vampire: The Masquerade Bloodlines.
Right. Oh yeah.
So that was actually a really fun title. It's a great IP. You know, I mean, for anyone that's into vampires probably knows about that White Wolf. And we did that with Activision. They were our publisher at the time.
Right.
And we were the first third-party developer to use the Source engine.
Right. Which is the Half-Life engine.
That's the Half-Life, Half-Life 2.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, once we shipped that, you know, I made some contacts at Activision. And, you know, Vampire came out, didn't do so hot at the time. And
it has a cult following, though, right?
I mean, it was a really great game. Like, I poured a lot of my heart and soul into that game. Did a lot of design on that game as well as art. But it just had some sort of fatal flaws that we just didn't get a chance to fix. And so, you know, although commercially it didn't do all that well, there was a really big cult following who ended up supporting the game well past the time when, you know, it was still for sale. And, you know, they made this crazy patch for it, which I guess now, like, if you buy the game, like, it's you're just expected, right? You go get the patch that these guys have put together, and it fixes a lot of the problems with the game. And so, you know, I would say at the time, sort of a pretty innovative 3D RPG. You know, kind of a precursor, I think, to games like BioShock and, you know, where, you know, you've sort of had this immersive 3D environment, you know, but you're telling kind of a compelling story along the way.
Right.
Anyway, from there, as you said before, I went and I worked at Treyarch Studios up in Santa Monica.
So Treyarch was known for their Spider-Man stuff, which is what you worked on, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now they're doing the Call of Duty stuff now,
almost exclusively. Yeah, in house. That's the only stuff they actually
right.
do.
Right. So, talk to me about Spider-Man. Which Spider-Man did you work on?
So, I worked on Spider-Man 3.
Okay.
So, like, not sure about what your opinion of Spider-Man 3 the movie was, Frost.
It's not very high.
Yeah, not too good.
Not the best Spider-Man. Even Sam Raimi hates that movie.
Yeah, I didn't. Did you see the article the other day where he finally came out and said, "Yeah, that's
it's awful." I don't want to get off on a rant here, but a lot of it was he wanted to do Sandman, and then the studio was like, "You need to put Venom in And so when you mix those two things, right. It was like, bah! And it came together as this jumbled kind of mess.
And then they threw the Hobgoblin in right at the last minute.
Right, and then they made Peter Parker do emo dancing, which is just awful. Anyway, so not to get on that tangent, but so you worked on Spider-Man 3.
Yeah.
And what were you doing on there? Still 3D modeling?
So yeah, that actually, after Troika, which was, you know, although like I felt really passionate about both Arcanum and Vampire. You know, I was kind of burned out.
Yeah.
You know, like it had been a sort of a tough last few months at Troika. You know, we were trying to get another gig and it just didn't work out. And so, you know, when I went to Treyarch, I just kind of said, you know, I just want to go someplace. I want to get myself an art job and I want to just, you know, I don't care about being a lead or anything. I just want to go and do some work and relax, right? And
sure. So
that lasted for a little while. They eventually made me like the lead character artist on the project. And, you know, like I met a ton and hired a ton of really talented people. I mean, Treyarch has just some unbelievable talent, especially now that they've sort of taken over on the Call of Duty stuff.
Right.
But really great guys there. They had a bunch of success with Spider-Man 2. You know, I think that was, you know, really sort of their breakout title.
Yeah.
Which was a good game, you know, at the sure. time. Spider-Man 3, you know, what I'd say is kind of like the movie. The game had some challenges. And although it probably is still my biggest selling game of my career, right? I mean, you know, despite some of its flaws, it still sold a ton of units and was a pretty popular game. But, you know, I think it, you know, I don't think about it in the same way that I think about, like, you know, Vampire Arcane or even Red Asphalt, which, you know, although a sort of strange PlayStation 1 game that never quite found its place. There's still a lot of good memories that I remember about
sure.
that.
So know. Let's talk about this for a little bit, because something that I find very fascinating and interesting about the video game industry is there's a lot of people that when they're not a part of it, they kind of go like, well, how do bad games get made? Or like, what? Why did this decision get made like this? Or like, what the hell happened here?
Yeah.
And a lot of times, I think it has to do with publishers, or it has to do with people outside of the development process kind of coming in. Was that part of it? Or what was the deal there?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's always a little bit of both, right? You know, I think on most of the games that I've worked on that had difficulties, some of the problems are actually problems that we've had in studio, right? Where, you know, you have leadership who's not necessarily making the right decisions, or have, like, you know, maybe the vision for the game isn't super clear or consistent, which is, if you don't have that on a team, then, you know, I think it's really hard to gel as a development studio and to actually, you know, be on point and make a great game. So I've run into those problems, and I've also run into, you know, where the studio itself was kind of, you know, what I would say, everyone's in line and they know what they want to do, and, you know, everyone's kind of working together. And then you'll get, you know, your publisher may come in, make some decisions on, you know, release dates or, you know, directions, let's say, for marketing. Or, you know, they may come in and make actual decisions that affect your design or your overall development process.
Right.
So, you know, I think it'd be nice if it was a simple answer, right? Like, yeah, well, it's always, you know, it's always the man who's coming down and sure. and messing with, you know, our creative process or whatever. But usually, you know, it just kind of depends on the project you're on, and, you know, sometimes, you know, or sometimes it's a combination of all those things. It just kind of depends.
Okay. So, all right, you're at Activision and you have now made a really successful title.
Yeah.
And then Carbine happens. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I had just shipped Spider-Man 3. I just had my first kid, And so I was kind of in this limbo state a little bit, right? There was another project that was kind of starting up at Treyarch. The Call of Duty team was also kind of looking to start to grow. So I had been talking to them a little bit. And then I got contacted by the guys at Carbine. And, you know, I knew a bunch of the... I actually knew a bunch of the guys that started the company. And then I knew quite a few others who had started working there afterwards, right? I mean, Orange County, it's kind of a strange, weird mecca, right, of video game development, you know? So yeah.
I would say even more so than L.A., which is kind of weird, you know? Like, normally that's the inverse, but there's a lot more development studios, Ready at Dawn and Blizzard and you know...
You've got Turtle Rock.
Yeah, Turtle Rock.
Right, yeah. I mean, and it's some really super successful studios, right?
Right.
And so, you know, what you find, right, as you work in a general area over the years, it's just like, you know, everybody kind of moves around a little bit. And so there have been a number of people who used to work at Interplay that were at Carbine. Some of the guys from Troika were at Carbine. And they... Because of the connections that I'd had at Troika, they knew that I could do design, you know, and you know, sort of world building and story, you know, story writing and that kind of thing. And so they were having trouble on that front at Carbine. And so they brought me down. They're like, hey, you know, like...
So when is this? This is like, what, 2006?
This is 2000. The first time they contacted me twice, the first time was 2006.
Okay.
And I was still at Activision, and I was under contract, and so I was like...
Got to finish your...
Yeah, I don't like ever leaving in the middle of a project anyway, but
right.
I'd also signed a piece of paper that said I would not do it, and there was probably some legal and financial ramifications if I did that, you know? So,
yeah.
So I told them, hey, you know, like, I want to finish out this project, but let's stay in contact, and then, you know... Within a couple of weeks after I shipped Spider-Man 3, I was talking to someone down there about something kind of unrelated, and they're like, oh, well, are you available? And I'm like, yeah. You know, I'm looking around, trying to figure out what's next. And so they brought me down, and, you know, I met the team, and they showed me the game, which, you know, even then was... pretty impressive.
Looked pretty good. So, okay, they pull you in, you start working there, and you start working into different sort of areas, right? So you had more of a design focus, and then you kind of shifted to doing more of the narrative design thing, right? So that starts picking up, and that's... So I know from reference, because I'm there.
Yeah.
Right? This is around 2010, I think, is when I started. So we start kind of developing stuff. It's still not WildStar. We started getting to that point. I wanted to talk about kind of the genesis of WildStar from a lore perspective, right? Which is basically your domain.
Yeah.
Somebody had a question. And by the way, if you ever have questions about this show, just do hashtag game devastation. So I'm going to look up that question really quick. But start out with telling me what is the first thing that you thought of for the WildStar IP?
Like, well,
how do you start that? Because so, it's a massive universe. How do you start it?
I think, you know, we've had some challenges, right, developing our IP and our game. And so we got to a point, right around the time that you're talking about, right around 2009, 2010. And, you know, it became obvious that what we were working on just wasn't working. You know, like, we had a great team. We had lots of people, lots of talented people, but it just wasn't gelling. And so we just kind of stopped and we decided, okay, we need to refocus. And so what happened is at the time, me and a couple of the other guys on the team, we were tasked with, okay, we need a new direction. And so they just set us in a room for, you know, it was a number of days, and they're just like, okay, you guys go figure something out and, you know, come back and tell us what you come up with, right? So, you know, I think there was a lot of ideas that got thrown around, you know, and what's difficult about that if you're doing it in the middle of your project is, you know, you have all of this other stuff that's come before. You know, some of it you like, some of it you don't like, some of it you want to hold on to, some of it you want to eject, you know. And it's hard sometimes to just come at it with like a clean slate and say, okay, anything that's come before, we need to be able to let go of. And so I think once we got to that point and we were just saying, okay, what could this be? That is when the discussions that led to what was going on, you know, what eventually became Planet Nexus, right? That is when they really began. But it started, you know, I kind of remember the discussions. It started originally with this idea of like a land grab, right? One of the guys that was in the room was like, hey, what if it was just like this place and, you know, everyone's coming here and everybody wants a piece. Like a piece space of the pie. Gold rush. Yeah, right. You know? And, you know, I mean, that wasn't anything at all, right? There's no lore, there's no name, there was no factions or whatever. It was just like that as a concept.
That's the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Right.
And that eventually, right, became, well, what if, you know, okay, well, what if the place that everybody wants is legendary? And the reason why everybody wants it now is because somebody just discovered it, you know, and so, like, all of a sudden, like, you know, we were kind of where we had been sort of floating in this ambiguous mist of, I don't know what to do, just a few ideas, right? And all of a sudden, like, boom, 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 we're like, yes, okay, that's great. That's a great premise, you know, like, and from there, right, everything else just kind of fell into place. And so, you know, people ask me a lot, you know, when you're coming up with an idea, let's say for a game or for, you know, a universe or whatever, like, you know, what's that process like? What's the most, you know, where do you start? What's the most important thing? And I tell people all the time, I mean, like, coming up with, like, just that compelling premise, right. You know, that very simple and, like, you know, compelling idea that draws just about anybody in is what is the most important thing. And then from there, there's still lots of hard work, but as long as everything fits around and, you know, with that premise, then you've done your job.
Right. So, okay. So we start to have this starting to form. And after that, you guys have to come up with the characters, right? And the different kind of races that you've got in the game. How did that form? 'Cause is this basically, it's you and Herndon and... And who else?
Actually, the three people at the beginning. So you mean like once we got past the initial point, or do you want to know who the three guys at the beginning
were? Well, yeah, I'll know that. I'd like to know that.
So that was Tim Kaine.
Okay.
You know, who now works over at Obsidian.
Yep.
And Corey Loftus, who, that's right. Okay. You know, was our extremely talented concept artist.
Yeah, he really defined a lot of the art
at the time.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, he was a really great artist, but I also, you know, would say he was a very, very just overall creative and talented individual, right? I think he had a really great knack for naming things. He was really good at...
he had a lot of personality in his art style.
And
the crazy thing now is he's a director over at Disney.
Yeah,
working on projects.
He worked on Frozen, did some work on Frozen. Yep. So, you know.
Talented dude.
Yeah,
exactly. To say the least.
After that, once we had sort of come up with, hey, here's the core of our game, here's what it's going to be about, right? You know, other teams went out and they were like, okay, well, you know, how do we take this and reflect this in gameplay? And right. You know, what's going to be the unique thing about WildStar? In these other places, what my department then did, narrative design, is we said, okay, well, we need to go and, you know, rewrite all of the lore around our races and our factions and our world groups. And that, I think, you know, when I think back to the work that we did in WildStar, that was like the most rewarding and just the most difficult, because there was just so much to do.
Yeah.
And the reality is, you know, in my opinion, it's vital that you work that stuff out in advance. Like, you know, for those of you that are out there kind of thinking about developing your own game, you know, what I would definitely warn you against is don't just jump into the middle of your game, you know, and start making levels and that kind of thing. If you don't, and I don't mean that you can't prototype things, but, you know, don't start finishing anything until you actually know your entire arc, right? You know where it begins and where it ends, and you know the players and the groups that are involved, because we kind of made that mistake in previous IPs. And the reason I think that WildStar worked really well from the beginning is that we didn't jump into really creating content until, you know, a majority of those things had been worked out.
Right. And to be clear, you were talking earlier about prototyping. I think one of the things in game development that is really critical is that you do test things from a mechanic standpoint. But what you don't do is, you know, put in these stories that, you know, if you're not having them fleshed out, it just means you're going to have to go back in and rework a lot of stuff. So if you can come in and say, like, well, this is what the combat is like. Well, we know it's going to be kind of space and ranged, and okay, well, we can work out some of that stuff.
Yeah.
That you can work on and you can do. But when it comes to, like, yeah, the story arcs and where you're going to go and what the lands are like and what all that stuff, you probably want to figure that stuff out prior to getting, you know, artists actually working on things and making it pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
So that starts. You guys begin coming up with these different characters. And I remember a time, too, when, and this was a little bit after that, this was probably a couple months, where we said, okay, let's figure out the entirety of the game, right? Let's figure out in each zone what's going on there, what characters are there.
Yeah,
Mike Donatelli, who's the now what director?
He's
is
the product director.
Okay, it's just too many directors. Yeah. So he's product director, and I remember you, Donatelli, myself, and Corey were in a room, and we were thinking of, you know, what these different areas need to be. We had your whiteboard was filled up with what's Galaris, what's the story there, what's going to be the story in Whitepage.
Yeah,
you know, and we basically provided this outline, and this is for the designers to kind of go in and say, okay, I need to create content around the ideas that are in these zones.
Yeah.
So we had, you know, White Veil. It was like a big conflict between the Exiles and, you know, the Dominion. And it was all about providing that those ideas for those designers to come up with, you know, angles to make content. So it's like, okay, here, if it's war here, then come up with quests that are about war between these two things.
Right.
Right. But it still allows them to be somewhat creative without saying, like, you will make exactly this quest.
Yeah.
And when you are done, you will come back for more.
Yeah. You know? No, I mean, and I think that's why doing all of that work at the beginning, you know, so if, in the case of WildStar, right, if you tell someone, okay, here's what a Grannach is. You know, here's what a Grannach is, here's what they care about, here's what they talk like, mm-hmm. you know, then you can say things like, okay, we have this zone, and there's a Grannach, you know, war camp here, and, you know, they're going after, you know, the secret thing at the other end of the zone.
Right.
And then, you know, unless there's some really specific story point you need to get across here, you can just say, and that's all the information you need. And then they can come up with characters and conflicts and storylines that jive with who the Grannach are and what they talk like and the things they care about.
Yeah, and the interesting point to that is, let's say that, you know, one team is responsible for doing the Exile side and the other's Dominion side. You would say, okay, this one is a Grannach war general who's going to be handling this. And then on the other side is a Chua war scientist or something like that. And how they... it's the same quest content, but how they give it to you and how they speak to you is kind of different, right? So I think that's a cool thing to kind of look at, even if you're writing, not even video game stuff, if you're just writing a comic book or you're doing a movie or something like that, defining what those character traits are and then putting the conflict in front of them, it almost kind of writes itself.
It does. I think it does if you've done your homework.
Right. You know, that's, you have to have that prep, though, right? You have to understand that Grannachs like to drink beer
right.
and like to fight. You know, as opposed to, you know, the Chua, who are just all about blowing things up with science and stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is a good way to kind of do prep. So, that's an interesting kind of point for development. And that's a lot of what we did on WildStar. So that happened. I remember we went over the zones and things like that. But then there's stuff that's like dungeons, right? Those are historically in other MMOs and in WildStar, they're more story-centric. Right. So with these, what was the thought process on how they were designed?
Well, I think, you know, we made a choice in WildStar to not count on our raids and dungeons to tell our important stories. It's not that they don't tell stories at all. Some of them actually tell what I would consider important stories, but they're not like the central stories to the overall arc of what's going on in the world. Right. And, you know, the reason that was because it's a smaller percentage of people who actually experience dungeons and raids. And usually those people are not the ones that care passionately, right, about the overarching story of the game and, you know, how things are developing and story arc development and that kind of thing. And so, so anyway, we decided to take all of, you know, or at least a lot of the exposition of story out of Dungeons and Raids and focus a lot more on gameplay. It's not that there aren't characters and things that you can find, but generally they are things that either you can seek out if you want to,
right,
or that are happening during your gameplay, so that if you're the kind of person that doesn't really care about a particular story point, you can just kind of tune it out and continue to fight the boss or whatever. So,
right.
You know, I thought, and I think generally that was pretty well received.
Yeah.
You know, like the people that play our dungeons, they really like them and they're fun. And the people that really like story get them in other places where they don't have to go in and risk their lives in order to do it. You know?
Die so, repeatedly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I want to ask you more questions. But before I do that, you know, one of the parts of the show that I really want to focus on is getting questions from the community. So let's go to community questions.
Yes.
Now, what you're hearing right now is metal music. And it's glorious. This is actually some stuff I made with a friend, so... This is awesome. Anyway, Chad, this is a question from Lethality, Twitter fan.
Yeah, good guy.
Yeah. He's actually got a lot of good questions, and this one specifically I like as well. What comes first, the character or the story? We kind of answered this actually a little bit. So it's more the story.
I think the story comes first, but I will say this, you know, and I've said this a number of times on Twitter and other sources of social media that the best stories are about characters. So I think you figure out, you know, your overarching story first, but if you want your stories to be memorable and compelling, they should be about whether it's you as a character or the characters that surround you and the changes that go on. I mean, you know, ultimately we are all characters in our own right. And so I think that's why stories about people and, you know, their struggles and how they change over time, I think, are the ones that we remember the most.
Sure. So this one is from Corey Cassoni. Good guy as well. Talk about the challenges of pleasing producers and publishers while maintaining a good design. That's a good one.
That is a good one. Well, I think the most important aspect of that particular question is that if you have done a great job of defining the vision for your game from the get-go, then it is much easier to make sure that producers and publishers are always in line with the decisions that you're making along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the murkier those your vision of what your game is, the murkier that is, then there's more room for people to come in and be like, well, I'm not quite sure about this decision, right? You know,
what,
like,
if you did this instead?
Right, you know. But if you're rock solid and like, look, this is our game. It is about X, Y, and Z. This decision is because, you know, it's about X.
Right.
We always do it, you know, like, we don't cut corners. And, you know, I think it's... I'm not saying that you still won't have people come in and question or say, hey, we don't have money for that, we don't have time for that.
Right.
But I think, you know, if you take the subjective parts of that out of the discussion, sometimes it's easier to win those battles.
Yeah, I think as well, the stuff that you've worked on historically has had publishers that are probably pretty good, actually, right?
I can tell you some horror stories because I worked with a company out in Utah called Sensory Sweep Studios, and we made some awful, awful games because it was something that you had to get done in like 6 months, and it was some no-name publisher, and maybe they've done two or three games, or you know, maybe they're just more about the visuals or things like that. So it's definitely harder. But I think a lot of the stuff, the companies that you worked with have been pretty, I don't want to say hands-off, but they know what they're doing, right?
Like, I'd say they've been, for many of the projects I've been on, they have been very generous, I think, in giving us as development teams room to grow and to sort of find our way. What I will say is this, you know, like, as you know, maybe this is just a function of, you know, getting to be an old man like I am now. But I have come to appreciate the role of the publisher in the development process. You know, I think that if you have a publisher who can hit that right balance between giving you room to make a great game, but also not giving you too much room to make bad mistakes, right?
Making course correct where
you know what I mean. Like, you know, they are vital to the process, and you know, I think when you're younger, or maybe just getting started in the industry, you don't quite understand that, right? You're just like, I know exactly what I'm doing, and you know, I should be given complete freedom, and you know, I think as you get older and you've had you get a few titles under your belt, especially if you work with a good publisher, you start to see, okay, you know, their role in this is really important. You know, A, give us some money to make cool games.
Right.
B, keep us on course, you know, and make sure that, you know, that we're not falling too far out of the boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can look at something like, to me, actually, a great example of a AAA publisher that has done really well is WB Games lately. In the past 6 years or something, they just seem to come out of nowhere where they had Arkham Asylum.
Yeah.
Fantastic game. You know, they purchased the Lego, you know, products. They let them do their thing. And those guys are really good at doing those Lego games, right? They picked up Mortal Kombat. They know what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like they let them do what they need to do, but they also kind of come in. I had a buddy who worked over at WB Games and as a producer on the publishing side. And it seemed like a lot of what they did was they let people do their thing, but they kind of came in and course corrected where necessary, or, you know, like maybe you're not thinking. The good thing is if you have a good publishing producer or a good publisher in general, they can point out where things have gone wrong in other games and bring it over to yours and say, like, you know, we've launched X amount of titles. We see where these things work and where they don't work. You know, where you're going down, I've seen this fail, don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I think if you have the right producer for that stuff, it really does help out quite a bit.
I think too, I mean, we were talking about publishers, but the other part of his question talked about producers. And I, you know, I would say the same thing that I said about publishers is, you know, you need good producers on your team. They're absolutely vital. You know, Frost, you were a great example of that. I think, you know, when you used to work at Carbine.
Thanks, baby girl.
But like, you know, having people on your team, you know, who are not necessarily focused on the same things as you are, but are still focused on making sure this project gets out on time, at high quality, the right people are looking at it. You know, I think it's definitely, it's an important piece of the puzzle. And so, you know, we have some really, really great producers at Carbine, and you know, we couldn't get the project done without them, no way.
Yeah, I think we'll have another producer on the show eventually, and we'll talk about what a producer does. But I feel like it's one of the hardest to describe to people that are not in the game industry role.
Yeah,
you know, it's basically get shit done.
Yeah,
is your ultimate goal.
Yeah,
and by hook or by crook, however that needs to happen, and whether it's organization or whether it's talking with people or whether it's even shielding you from the publisher saying all these terrible things and then figuring out what out of that needs to transpire. And then there's a lot of stuff. So we'll talk to producers eventually when they get in here. We'll trade war stories on that. So another question from the community. This is from Adrian Marquez. Some storytellers use Easter eggs to allude to other works. Are they distractions? Or is it a story-loving homage?
That's an interesting question. So what I would say is I think that referencing, you know, whether it's games or pieces of literature, you know, sort of hinting at those things or sort of giving a wink to those things, right, in your content, I think that's okay. You know, like, I will say that I think it can go too far. You know, like, one of the things in WildStar that we, at least at the beginning of development, we tried to stay away from was, you know, pop culture references, you know, like, and it's difficult, right? Because it's kind of almost become like an industry thing, you know? Like,
well, I think it's an industry thing, but specifically for MMOs, it seems to be. I mean, you can look at WoW, they had like Harrison Jones.
Right. You know?
I see what you guys are doing here.
Yeah. You know? And so as a team, some of us anyway, we just felt, you know, sometimes those things don't age well, you know, like, and so although we like humor in WildStar, we try not to fall too hard on the pop culture side of things. You know, I think things have slipped through the cracks, and that's okay. You know, like, but you know, I think to answer the question, I think it's okay if you feel passionate about another person's work and you want to, you know, put an Easter egg in there that kind of hints and sort of, you know, give some credence to that opinion. I think that's okay.
So, like an Andy Warhol quest
would be cool with you. Exactly.
Right. Random ass. okay, cool. So this one is a question from Rabid. What unique challenges arise with game design versus other mediums for storytelling?
Well, I think it depends on the game. You know, I think for some games, it is an awesome medium for telling stories. You know, games like
The Walking Dead recently.
Walking Dead.
Or Last of Us.
BioShock. Yep. You know, like those games, because of the way that they're structured, lend themselves, I think, to awesome storytelling experiences.
Well, let's talk about the difference between, because I think if I can assume where you're going with this, if you look at more open world games versus what you were just talking about, which are very linear, controlled right. spaces, the difference between those two is in an open world game, a player can run in multiple directions, and with an MMO specifically, you have other players around in the area. So if you do something for one player, you have to do it for everybody else.
Right.
Right. But as opposed to like Last of Us, they're basically corridors. They're beautiful corridors.
Right.
Yeah. That distract you from the fact that they are corridors. But you can tell a story a lot easier when you can control a player's direction.
Right. Or at least if you have bottlenecks where you're like, I know, okay, they can go anywhere for a little while, but I know they're gonna have to go through this point right here,
right?
So I can do something. So like in WildStar, right, there is one point, one bottleneck for the entire game, which is at the very beginning.
Right.
That's the only place that we know everybody has to go. Everybody will have, like, the arc ships in WildStar were the only place that we knew for sure you were going to have to play that content.
Right.
Right. Beyond that, a player may never see any stories that we develop, any cinematics, any quest lines. We can't control that. That is the good thing about an MMO from a gameplay perspective, and it is the nightmare of an MMO from a storytelling perspective, right? Right. So, you know, that's my boohoo, you know, wah-wah, right, about MMOs.
Baby.
Right. Now, I will say this, right? I think, that being said, we have done a great job, I think, in WildStar of finding places to tell stories, guiding people who really want to experience stories in WildStar, getting them to that content and allowing them to experience it. You know, I think there's lots of other MMOs out there that do a good job of telling stories. So, but it's, you know, my only point is that it's more challenging, I think, in an open world environment to tell like a linear and consistent and compelling story than it is, you know, in some of the other games that we're originally talking about.
Gotcha. So I've got two more questions.
All right.
This one is from Krumer or Crummer. I'm not sure. How do you come up with the names for characters and places?
So I'm going to give you a dirty secret about myself.
Dirty secret. Awkward.
Which is probably the least favorite part of my job.
Coming up with names.
Like, it is just frustrating sometimes, right? Because you know every time when you've come up with a bad name, okay? Every single, you're just like, nope, that sucks. Nope, that's horrendous. And you also know when you've come up with a good one. It's just coming, so, and it's really easy to come up with bad ones and extremely difficult to come up with ones, at least for me personally. Right?
Here's my question. Who came up with the name Bezgalore for the planet name of the chip?
I don't know. That might have been me.
That is a ridiculous-ass name. It's a good ridiculous-ass name.
Good for the Chua, right?
It's good for the Chua. Yeah. The first time I heard it, I think I lulled a little bit. But it's such a ridiculous sci-fi name,
yeah.
You know? But it is super difficult. Even if the hard part is you guys are coming up with, alien tongues and languages that don't exist.
Right.
And so you got to think like, well, you know, the Draken, because I remember you guys wrote these documents for designers to kind of look and say like, this is how the Draken speak.
Yeah.
You know, they use these sort of things. There's a lot more consonants in their you know,
right.
Their, inflection and things like that. So if you're just coming up with stuff for a normal everyday game, like Tony Hawk, you know, like, well, I'm going to call this place
Santa Monica,
Santa Plaza, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Santa Plaza. Yeah. But if you're coming up with an alien thing, that's a lot harder, I would think.
Right? It's hard. And so, you know, there are some people who are really good at it. You know, we were talking about Corey Loftus earlier. Corey was great at naming things. It just made me ill how easy he could come up with, like, cool, totally unique names. So, you know, my process for that often comes from, you know, thinking about, you know, either looking at a concept and saying, okay, well, you know, what word does that thing look like? Are there any real world touchstones? So you might use roots of words and then kind of take those in different directions, you know? But, you know, I think what I can say very easily is that, like, whatever way I get to that, because I come at it from a lot of different angles, usually it's hard and painful and, you know, oftentimes I don't ever get to exactly what I think is an awesome name, but there's a few examples, a few exceptions, I think. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. So this one is from Carbine Studios' own Tony Ray. Everyone knows lore is the most crucial part of design, but why does metal music suck so bad?
Oh man.
Dude, Chad likes metal. First of all,
I do like some metal.
Yeah.
I like me some metal. Yeah.
I love metal. And Tony has terrible taste in music.
Yeah. What is Tony's taste? I mean, I don't even know.
It's terrible top 40 stuff. He's like Taylor Swift. And,
oh, wow.
You know, he's all about, like, the sad part is I can't even reference a song because I don't know what's in the top 40 right now. Right. I do know that it's terrible, and I don't even have to hear it. I'm not being close-minded. Right. I'm giving it the shot. It's all awful. Right. So there you go, Tony. And there's actually one here as well. You know, it's funny, when I posted this originally, I said, hey, should I do a podcast about game development? And a bunch of people are like, yeah, dude, sounds good, blah. Right, just went down the list. And there was one guy that was like, as long as you don't ask softball questions. So I said, okay, well, so here's one that's not, I would consider not a softball that I got today when I asked about questions. And it's not for you, Chad, it's for me.
Oh, okay.
Why did Stefan really leave Carbine? The answer to that is I got a really good offer at Amazon, and it's a really big company, and it's an exciting thing that I get to work on. I can't talk about it at all, but that's pretty much it. It wasn't like I was asked to leave. It wasn't like I said, screw this place, man, and everybody in it. You know, I still get along great with pretty much everybody there. So no weirdness or anything like that. I just got a really good offer at another company. So, yeah.
Good answer, buddy.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
Yeah.
So, we'll conclude this segment of community questions.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah. So much awesome metal there.
I'm going to edit that in post, by the way. That's why Chad had to put that in, so that he knew that there was going to be music in between there. So that's fix it in post.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got some questions specifically about narrative design, because we've talked a lot about you and where you came from and your experience, but I wanted to ask some questions about how you tell stories in games. It's a big one. I know it's very broad, and you can go into this, but how do you do that? Like, how does one tell a story in an MMO?
Well, I think it's funny. We've been having a lot of discussions about this. I think, you know, like with anything, you have to start, you know, with the foundation, right? So let's just say that we're developing a new zone, and we want to know what the stories are in that, right? Well, I think, you know, the very first question is, okay, well, what is the conflict here? You know, like, what's the backdrop? What is the reason why you as a player are coming here? What's the problem you have to solve, you know? And that needs to be compelling, you know, like, and interesting. Like, if you can't hook someone right away with, like, hey, I've come to this new place and something cool is going on, you know, if you're just like, yeah, I mean, I came to this place and, you know, there's a library and I'm going to take some books out, you know, like, that's not a cool concept.
Sounds epic.
Yeah.
What kind of library is it?
Right, you know? I mean, if it was like a haunted library or something, right? That would be kind of cool, right?
Yeah, so, and you have to check out like a haunted book of death.
Right, exactly.
From the librarian of from hell. I already want to play this game.
So I think, you know, you start out, you've got to get yourself, you got to define your conflict, you know, you got to, you know, sort of figure out who the players are, right? You know, who's involved, you know, why are those people interesting? You know, what are the stakes, right? That's a thing we've been talking a lot about lately is like, you know, a story is not interesting unless there are stakes, you know, like if you don't
juicy,
do this,
juicy stakes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you don't do this thing in the next 10 minutes, you know, the whole town will explode, you know, or like, you know, I mean, or, you know, if you don't get the blade of unending death, then, you know, we'll kidnap your family and you'll never see him again or whatever, right? You know,
the blade of unending death.
I figured you'd
so metal,
that, right?
Yeah.
But stakes, I think, are a really important part of a compelling story, right? Like, there needs to be that thing that drives you, you know, that if you fail, you know, something bad is going to happen.
Sure.
You know, and then I think, like we talked about before, you know, stories that are driven by characters are the most interesting, right? So who are the characters? What are their motivations?
Let's talk about that a little bit. How do you create interesting characters in games?
I think the most interesting characters are oftentimes the ones who are the most unlike us, or at least most unlike the way that we generally project ourselves, you know? Like, I think the you know, the characters that you remember the most are, you know, the ones that have that fatal flaw, you know, that they just can't help themselves, right? Like, you know, you think about, like, Tony Soprano or, like, Walter White, you know. Each one of those guys had something, right, that they just couldn't get past, right? Or they, you know, they kept making the same mistakes. And so those kinds of characters, I think, are, you know, the most interesting, right? Like, so when you're developing characters, you oftentimes you need to think about those things, right? Like, what is the thing that drives this character? What is the thing that is going to make them fail or could make them fail? You know, if you have those things defined from the outset, then it's easier to tell stories about them. You know, like, I think you and I have talked about Ned Stark, right? If you're talking about Game of Thrones, you know, Ned Stark's fatal flaw was that he was too noble. You know, he, you know, here was this poor guy who, you know, was like a stand-up guy, wanted to do the right thing.
Spoiler alert, by the way. Turn away if you haven't watched Game of Thrones or read the book.
I mean, I won't say what happens, right? But that was his flaw, you know, which was, I mean, that's a great flaw, right? Like, there's nothing wrong inherently about being too noble. unless you happen to exist in a world where nobody else is that way, right? You know,
it's all corrupt.
Yeah, you know. So, well, anyway.
Well, yeah. So I think there's that. Another big thing, just personally speaking, and a lot of story writers will say this, like conflict is the big thing that drives a lot. So a great example from a pop culture reference is, like, let's take the movie Avengers, right, based on the comic book. Tony Stark and Thor and Bruce Banner all have their own weird little eccentricities and are very different from one another. But when you put them together talking about a situation, that's where the magic kind of happens, right? Like, Tony Stark is this kind of sarcastic, stuck up, ultimately noble guy. Whereas you have someone like Bruce Banner, who's pretty smart and, is wanting to have things that he wants to get done, but he's got this weird affliction that he doesn't want to Hulk out. And then you have Thor, who's like speaking in the thine and thou and doesn't understand anything of what's going on from a,
cultural real world perspective. Right,
So you have all those three people, and it's like, okay, well, let's put all three of them at a car wash.
Yeah.
And they're waiting for their car to get done, right? How they interact with the environment and what they do, that's where I think a lot of that personality comes in. And they're like, they don't have the money to pay for the car. And they're like, well, what are we going to do, right? It kind of comes to that with conflict and how you solve that with those character personalities.
Yeah.
Right? So,
did you see that? I think it was like on IO9, they released this it was a clip from Avengers that they cut. Or maybe it was Avengers 2, I don't know, but it was just a conversation between Tony Stark and Steve Rogers. And they were, like, chopping wood, right? Like, splitting logs for firewood or whatever. And they were talking about America, I think, right? Or the military or something. And, so they're kind of arguing a little bit over the way things should be. And, there's this kind of building tension because they both have axes and, you know what I mean? Like... And it was just this really interesting, simple interaction, conversation between the two. But because it was in this kind of more mundane kind of backdrop, right? I think the sort of subtleties of their personalities and their characters kind of came out. It was pretty cool.
So now in games, right? We just talked about that kind of from the movie perspective. But when you have games, how do you get those personalities across to people? How do you kind of sell that?
I think, sadly, I shouldn't say sadly because it's cool when you can do it, right? But the best way is when you can hear them, right? So, in MMOs, a lot of times the delivery of story and missions is through text. But, what we have found, and, it's no secret, right? Like, if you really want to push forward a character and their personality, and build a scene, in which they can really thrive, you need to hear them, right? You need to hear both what they're like and their dialect and their inflection, but also their emotions. And so I think that is a vital component. Cinematics are a good way to do it. You don't always need to have cinematics, but it's a good way sometimes to take a little break, from the sometimes pretty hectic gameplay in any kind of game. Sit back, experience a little story, and then get back into it. So, but what I will say is this: my favorite games and my favorite stories are the ones that actually take place while you're playing, right? I always say that the greatest marriage of narrative and gameplay is through Portal. I think like Portal and Portal 2 are sort of the greatest examples, I think, of where you are playing and revealing and being involved in the story because you're playing through the gameplay that they've set up, right? Like, it's a pretty awesome way. So, those are good examples, I think.
Right. Okay. Well, Chad, I'm going to tell you, man, we've been talking here for a while now. I think we're going to call it.
Oh, my God. I think that's it.
We're bringing it to a conclusion.
All right.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I really appreciate it. Chad Moore, creative director at Carbine Studios. Thank you for coming by.
Hey, Frost, man. My pleasure. Someday I hope to put on my resume pilot interviewee on Game Devastation.
Right. You could be like, I was number one on Game Devastation. Kind of a big deal.
And hey, look, I just want to put it out there. I'm ready to come back onto the show anytime.
Okay. Whoa. You know what I'm saying? Right, man.
Yeah.
You know what? We have one listener. That's happening. Well, cool. Well, Chad, thank you so much for your time. Yeah, I really appreciate it. And thank you for listening to the show. Please check out our Patreon. Again, you could just Google Patreon and Stefan Frost and you'll find it. Thank you for the time. I appreciate it. Thanks. I'm going to say thanks 900 more times. Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day, guys. Adios.